Perhaps the marshal could call us back into order.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Johnson, Judge Gaetis, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning, counsel. We are ready now for the second case on today's oral argument calendar. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is May 27, 2021. The next case for oral argument is State versus Joseph Harold Specht, number A20-1420. I believe both attorneys are familiar with our rules and procedures. So Mr. McLaughlin, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Michael McLaughlin. I'm an attorney from the State Public Defender's Office, and I'm representing the appellant Joseph Specht on this case. Mr. Specht's probation was violated based on his conduct of possessing images of his own naked body and sharing them with his wife. The state claimed that Mr. Specht's possession of images of himself violated the condition that prohibited him from possessing or using pornography. To revoke Mr. Specht's probation on this basis violated due process and the First Amendment. But before turning to these serious constitutional questions, I'd like to focus on simpler errors that occurred in this case. And specifically, I'd like to focus on each of the four purported violations cited by the district court. None of these violations provided a basis to revoke Mr. Specht's probation. Beginning with the first condition, that prohibited Mr. Specht from having unsupervised conduct or contact with unrelated minor females. The evidence that the state offered to prove this violation was that Mr. Specht went to a pool with his adult sister and his minor nieces. This evidence does not establish that he violated the condition, because it shows neither that the conduct was unsupervised, since he was there with his sister, his adult sister, nor that the contact was with unrelated minor females, because he was there with his nieces. In respondent's brief, respondent focuses on testimony given by the probation officer that there were other minors present at the pool whom she did not recognize. But we'd note that this evidence was not relied on by the district court to support the violation. Instead, the court found the violation based on him going to the pool with his nieces. Second, that there's no evidence.
Mr. McLaughlin, I just want to stop you. So I hear the arguments that you've made here and in your brief regarding the violations that may be a closer case, but didn't the appellant admit that he was in violation of his probation because he didn't complete sex offender treatment, which was a condition of his probation? And if so, wouldn't that alone have been sufficient for the district court to revoke probation here?
Thank you, Your Honor. He did admit to violating his sex offender treatment at CORE, and we're not disputing that. But under the circumstances of this case, the violation of that condition does not provide a basis to revoke probation for a few reasons. First, the violation of treatment, the record shows that was really derivative of his conduct of having the images of himself on his phone and sharing them with his wife. His counselor at CORE was contacted by his probation agent the day after she recovered, or the day after she found the pictures, and then he was terminated that same day. Up until that time, he'd been in treatment for 2 years, and based on a letter that's in the record, he was doing well in treatment. So although he was violated from treatment, that really factually that was intertwined with the conduct of possessing the pictures on his phone and sharing them with his wife. Second, the court did state that he could return to treatment in the future, and even outlined sort of requirements he would need to meet if he went back to treatment. So they were still contemplating him returning to treatment. This shows that under the circumstances of this case, the policies favoring probation are not outweighed by a need for confinement. The place where he could get rehabilitated, which is the primary purpose of probation, was in the community at CORE, and they were keeping the door open for him to return. The record does not suggest that he could receive rehabilitation in prison. So based on that, though he did violate the condition relating to treatment, that doesn't provide a sufficient basis to revoke probation in our view.
District judge said, Mr. McLaughlin, at the second hearing, the district judge said that he had not made any progress in 2 years' time. Was there other evidence in the record of his performance in treatment other than simply the photographs that arose before?
There was a letter that's in the record that references his progress in treatment. It was relating to when his agent was asking the court to modify a condition that would allow him to, I believe, pick up his daughter from school. And there's references to him progressing in treatment at that point. So we'd cite that, but I mean, beyond that, it does appear that the revocation from treatment was really triggered by the discovery of the pictures on the phone. And it was a compressed timeline too, between when those pictures were discovered and when he was terminated. I believe the pictures were taken on July 10th, and then he was terminated from CORE on July 13th. So there wasn't a period where after he engaged in the conduct, he was going to treatment and not disclosing it. This all happened fairly quickly. So based on the record, the record does support that he was doing well in treatment for 2 years. There's no allegation that he ever missed treatment or failed to comply with the requirements up until his violation occurred.
Do we know the passage of time between when the photographs were taken and when the probation officer discovered them?
I believe all but one of the photographs were taken on July 10th. There was one previous picture where
that was taken
in May, I believe.
But. And when did the probation officer discover them again?
I believe she discovered them on July 12th.
2 days later, okay.
Yeah, and then she contacted CORE on July 13th, and the warrant was issued for his arrest on July 14th.
With respect to the violation that was found concerning contact with minor females, in your view, how should we interpret the word contact?
It's not defined specifically in the condition. We'd ask that court look at meaningful contact that involves some communication, some type of interpersonal communication between Mr. Speck and someone else. But even if the court took a more broad view of contact and said it was just being near minor females, there still isn't evidence in the record to show that there was anyone at the pool that was unrelated to Mr. Specht and that was female. The only testimony was that there were people at the pool that the agent did not recognize, but there's no evidence he knew what his nieces looked like. So those other people could have been his nieces, and there's no evidence those other people were female. In addition, he was during that time supervised by his sister. His sister was present, and it wasn't part of the court's condition that the supervisor needed to be his wife. So again, looking at the court's condition, which has to form the basis for the violation, he didn't violate that condition by going to the pool with his sister and his nieces.
Well, so I mean, you say they were nieces as if that's a fact. Is that in evidence? My understanding is the only witness at the first hearing was the probation officer. So I mean, where is the evidence that the children, not his own children, were nieces?
He made an admission to the probation officer that she testified to at the hearing. So his admission that they were his nieces are also in evidence. And
okay, she conveyed his statement that the other children with him were nieces. Related.
Yes. And then the The other violation was for Mr. Specht using an unauthorized internet capable device. That violation was based on him using his daughter's phone to communicate with his wife by Facebook Messenger. It was limited to one occurrence. The record also suggests that he admitted that to his agent at the time it occurred back in April. So that one violation by itself is too technical in our view to justify revocation and doesn't show that he presents a public safety risk sufficient to outweigh the policy's favor in continued rehabilitation in the community. So that brings us to the final violation regarding the alleged possession and use of pornography. Even without reaching the constitutional issues, this court could find that conduct does not violate the condition, or in the alternative that even if it is a technical violation, that given that it was of his own body and that he shared them with his wife, that doesn't require revocation or justify revocation. The definition of pornography based on dictionary definitions applies to the activities of other people. Viewing the image of one's own body is outside the definition of pornography, pretty plainly. I mean, looking at an image in a mirror is plainly would not be pornography, and there's no reason why that should be converted to pornography just because that image is, you know, reduced to a digital form or a photographic form. Similarly, sexual relations between married persons is not within any reasonable definition of pornography, and it should not be converted to pornography just because that sexual relationship occurs through a photographic or texting form.
Mr. McLaughlin, can you be specific about what is your authority? I'm looking at your brief now, starting at page 16, I believe. What is your authority for the proposition that the definition of pornography does not include photographs of oneself? That the requirement is that it be an image of another person. Where do you find that?
That comes from dictionary definitions of the term pornography.
Are they in your brief? I'm just trying to be specific and looking at the particular language that you're referring to.
So, the origin of the word refers to depictions of activities of prostitutes, which would be activities of other persons. Courts have cited that definition of pornography.
I think that's sort of an ancient definition, right? I think that might be the origin of the word. It's an ancient definition, but you continue, please.
There is no statutory definition of pornography, and there's no authority in Minnesota specifically defining that term to exclude images of oneself. But at the same time, a number of courts have looked at the definition of pornography, and typically they'll strike down conditions because it's overbroad and unconstitutionally vague when it's read to include all nudity. So although courts haven't specifically said pornography excludes pictures of oneself, they have struck down definitions of pornography that are as broad as the way it was applied in this case. The origins of the word are consistent in our view of with it involving the activities of other persons. And if they are, if a pornography could include images of oneself, that would pose all the constitutional problems that that we outline in our brief. It violates the Constitution in two independent ways in our view. The first is that because the condition would burden the fundamental right of marriage, of marital privacy relating to sexual matters, and of one's own privacy over one's own sexuality, that because of Bernal's rights, it only survives constitutional scrutiny if the condition is tailored to further the legitimate policies of probation. And here, applying that pornography condition to Mr. Specht's possession of his images of himself and those shared with his wife would not further the policies of probation, or it's not necessary to further the policies of probation, because the relationship with his wife was something that reduced his likelihood of reoffense and was a pro-social factor.
Well, so relationship with his wife is one thing, but his own acknowledgement is that when he looks at porn and couples that with alcohol, that's a triggering mechanism for his behavior. So why wouldn't that be a rational nexus, the pornography view, and therefore a reasonable condition of probation?
Well, I think if it excluded pictures of himself and pictures of his wife, that it would be a reasonable condition. The problem here is probation didn't view his sexual activities with his wife as something that was contrary to his rehabilitation, and she was designated as a support person, showing that they viewed that relationship as something that was helpful to Mr. Specht. So the reason it's problematic in this case is because it was applied to that relationship between him and his wife. And there wasn't anything to show that relationship created a public safety risk that justified the condition. The underlying offense did not involve his wife. It also did not involve him exposing himself, indecent exposure, something like that. It was really factually unrelated to the conduct that it was applied to in this case. So based on that, we feel that wouldn't survive the scrutiny required because it does burden a fundamental right. Just very briefly, the other, and it's fully described in the brief, but the argument is that it would be unconstitutionally vague as well. But
Mr. McLaughlin, your time expired a minute or two ago. You're moving on to a new topic, it appears. I think it'd be appropriate for you to save that for your rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
You will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Mr. Smith, on behalf of the state.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith. I'm a special assistant Lacaparo County attorney representing the state of Minnesota, respondent in this appeal. I want to actually jump right into Judge Werke's question and why it presents every reason why we should not be deciding and considering this constitutional question for the first time on appeal. Judge Werke's question hit at the question of the rational relationship between the condition of probation and the conduct to which it was applied in this case. That isn't, because we're in an as-applied challenge, because the question here would be whether that condition was narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling state interest, the state was entitled to put on evidence to demonstrate that that condition met constitutional muster as applied to this defendant. It's not simply an abstract question of whether this condition is constitutional facially. Even that should be raised for the first time and presented to the district court. But here, the record is not adequately developed at all because appellant failed to present his constitutional arguments to the district court. The counsel's attempt to answer Judge Werke's question demonstrated all of the problems with the record here and all of the reasons why this court, the Minnesota Supreme Court, require constitutional issues to be presented to and decided by district courts before being considered on appeal. And I don't know that I personally could have made a more compelling argument for waiver of these constitutional issues than Judge Werke's question made just now. This is in reality an extraordinarily simple case, as Judge Gaetis hinted at with her first question. Appellant is a repeat sex offender who has never completed sex offender treatment, despite two opportunities to do so in the community while on probation for separate offenses. He admitted that he violated the terms of his probation by failing to complete sex offender treatment. And to this day, he has never argued that that violation was either unintentional or inexcusable.
Do we know the reasons why he was terminated? And I mean, where are those expressed? I mean, I don't think we have anything from the treatment provider herself or himself.
I believe we actually do. I think included in the probation violation report was a letter from Core Professional Services dated July 14th, explaining the defendant, the appellant's termination from outpatient sex offender treatment at Core. And the letter says, it has come to this writer's attention that appellant has been engaging in hypersexual, high-risk behavior, which he has been withholding from treatment. The writer is also aware that the appellant's wife had moved out of their home. His unhealthy behavior, secret keeping, and double life parallel his pattern of sex offending and place him at an increased risk to the community. He does not seem to possess the internal motivation to change at the present time, and he would benefit from an external motivator such as behavioral consequences.
And the hypersexual conduct that's referenced there, is it anything other than what the probation officer discovered on his phone?
As far as I'm aware of, no. I don't think we have any facts in the record that suggest that that is something other than that. But I want to drill down into the details of this behavior, these photos. It's not just the possession of the photos on his phone that's troubling and was concerning to the probation agent and to his treatment providers. He sent those photos unwelcomed to his somewhat estranged wife. He sent one photo after she specifically asked him not to send any more photos like that. And she basically, in the text message exchange, explained that this isn't the kind of thing he should be doing. So the defendant's showing here what the treatment provider, I think, rightly concluded is hypersexualized behavior. What's also troubling is the fact that it was unwanted by the recipient. The record is clear on that. This was not something that was wanted by the recipient of the contact. And that's it. We're here on a criminal sexual conduct offense where the defendant was engaging in unwanted sexual contact with a minor. I understand that this is his wife, but he's crossing boundaries. And so it was reasonable based on those facts for the treatment provider, certainly, to conclude that he hadn't made significant progress in treatment, despite having been in treatment for 2 years, and therefore to terminate him. And appellant now tries to argue, well, because these explicit pictures of himself were the underlying basis for his termination from treatment, that you really can't treat his termination from treatment as a sufficient independent basis to revoke his probation and execute his sentence. And that just doesn't stand up to scrutiny. Because
Mr. Smith? Let's talk about the violation about possessing pornography. The sentencing order, which reflects the judge's comments at sentencing, says do not access or possess pornography. So are the photos on his phone pornography, and how do we know, what's our source for interpreting, or sources for interpreting the word pornography? And I guess especially, of course, the distinction between images of oneself or images of others.
Well, I again reiterate that I really don't think this court should be reaching this. I guess this is a question of the sufficiency of the evidence. So whether they constitute pornography as a plain definition is legitimate.
Well, I think this goes to the first requirement of Austin Motlin. Was there a violation? He was the district judge found he violated that term that I just read.
Correct.
And that hinges on the, to me, it hinges on the definition of the word pornography.
Yes. And I think if you go to one of the definitions of pornography that appellant has provided in his own brief from Collins Dictionary, pornography refers to books, magazines, and movies that are designed to cause sexual excitement by showing naked people or referring to sexual acts. Certainly, even if the simple act of him taking the pictures wouldn't fall within that definition of pornography, and again, I think that that's absurd, because that would mean that pornography is not pornography in the hands of the creators it's only pornography once it's been distributed to third parties. And I think if we look at the laws regarding child pornography, for example, where we distinguish between creation of pornography, dissemination of pornography, and possession of pornography, that can't possibly be true. Pornography by itself doesn't depend on who's depicted. It depends on what's depicted. And the fact that he sent these pictures of his own exposed genitalia to his wife, if that's not intended to cause some sort of sexual excitement in either himself or his wife, I don't know what possible purpose they served. So I think by the definition appellants given in his own brief at page 24 from Collins Dictionary, this court can conclude that that was pornography.
Let me move Mr. Smith to the finding of the violation concerning being present at the pool with unrelated female minors. So the sentencing order says, have no unsupervised contact with unrelated female minors. What does the word contact mean and how do we interpret that?
I think contact is broad, and that has to be read in the light of the purpose of the probationary conditions, which is to promote rehabilitation and prevent reoffending. And it's intended to prevent the defendant from being in a position where he could offend against minors. So that means being present in the same location where unrelated females are present. I think that's the only reasonable interpretation that can be given to that condition of probation in this case.
Well, but I guess when you say location, I mean, how specific? I mean, this was an outdoor pool that was, I don't know the size. Let's assume it was 100 feet by 200 feet. Are you saying that he's having contact with every person who is in the pool, near the pool?
Yes, I maintain that he is, especially given the ease and fluidity, pardon the pun, of movement in pools, and the fact that minors there aren't generally supervised by their parents often. I certainly think that that's a reasonable, that's the same location. If you've got the same address, I would submit if you're at the same address, you're in the same location.
We have an opinion for this court interpreting the words no contact in an OFP, and we referred to dictionary definitions. This is FIPS. Referred to dictionary definitions of the word contact as coming together or touching as of objects or surfaces, the state of or condition of touching or of immediate proximity, or connection or interaction communication. I mean, under that definition, do you think that he had contact with unrelated minor females?
I think immediate proximity is certainly fits. I guess if the court is requiring probationary conditions to be more narrowly tailored than that, it's going to be very cumbersome and very, very, we're going to have very, very long sentencing orders that basically dictate every jot and tittle of a probationer's life. Provide no room for the district court to exercise its sound discretion in determining whether there's been a violation.
But is this a matter of discretion, or is this something that we should review de novo? What the sentencing order says and requires?
I think that the district court is in the best position in the first instance to determine what the sentencing order says and requires.
What deference should we give to the district court's interpretation of the word contact?
In its own sentencing order, I think that the deference should be an abuse of discretion, because the overarching question in the probation revocation context is whether this district court has abused its discretion, and so that we review the findings of fact for clear error. I guess the question of whether he had contact with unrelated females is reviewed for clear error. To treat it like a statute seems like the wrong approach. That simply doesn't seem to be a reasonable approach to interpreting probationary conditions.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Judge Johnson.
Maybe just one more point, and I, Austin and Motlin talk about the concept of fair notice as a matter of due process, that the probationer must have fair notice of what is prohibited. And so does that not put some responsibility on the district court to write conditions that are clear enough that a person would know? I mean, if I wanted to go to the pool with my sister and her children, her female children, I might look at that and say, have no unsupervised contact with unrelated female minors. I might say, I'm fine.
That would require interpreting, viewing this all in a vacuum. It would require viewing this condition of probation and the point at which he's alleged to have violated it in a vacuum. He had, the condition was articulated. He had met with his probation agent. The expectations under the sentencing order were made clear to him. The concepts of supervision and contact were made clear to him. He was told that the person who had to supervise his contact with unrelated females was his wife. And he was told that that contact means being in the same location.
I have follow-up questions on that, but I should let Judge Gaetis ask the next question.
Well, you know, Mr. Smith took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to, my question was, are we viewing this in a vacuum? And would this be a different case if the underlying offense, for example, was not a case involving criminal sexual contact with minors? If it was a drug case, would the district court be entitled within its discretion to view the condition, the pool condition, or the contact with minors condition differently? And I think you answered that question.
It certainly would. And I, with the remaining time I have, I want to emphasize that the defendant's plain error claim is absolutely waived and inappropriate to be raised for the first time in a reply brief. It's a completely different claim. The state was deprived of an opportunity to even respond to his plain error claim by the fact that it was made for the first time in a reply brief. It places the burden squarely on the defendant to establish all of those things. And moreover, it must fail because there's no precedent from this court, the Minnesota Supreme Court, or the United States Supreme Court that says that possession of pornography probationary conditions are unconstitutional. And in the absence of binding precedent, any error a district court could have made here could not possibly have been plain. Any constitutional error could not have been plain because there was no binding law on point. For all of the reasons articulated in my brief and everything I've said here today, I respectfully ask this court to affirm the revocation of appellant's probation. Thank you.
I'd like to go back to the issue, the definition of contact. And you made reference, I think, to that the probation officer made clear her expectations. And there was a document, right? She had a document about what no contact meant. Is it your view that we should consider that document as when we're interpreting the judge's sentencing order?
It is because it, one, gives context and it addresses the concerns about fair notice. And two, it's not the sole basis that I rely upon for making that the argument that this was contact. And I go back to the fact that he was physically present at the same location with other minor females. And the district court had the pictures. It had the actual evidence. It could view that. And it decided based on that evidence, which was presented to it, that the defendant had contact with unsupervised minor females.
Well, let me re-ask the question. I mean, is the probation officer's definition of contact or no contact, is that, in your view, incorporated into this district court's sentencing order? Or is it a factor to consider, or is it no consideration whatsoever?
I think it's a factor to consider. I wouldn't go so far at this point without having done substantially more research on that point to say that it's incorporated into the district court's order. But I think it's a factor to consider, and it has to be considered when you look at the judge. I want to remind this court that these are the sentencing judges, generally speaking, who make these decisions on whether the sentencing order has been violated. And so if the primary concern then is whether the judge's sentencing order put the defendant on fair notice, then I think what the probation agent has explained before the violation becomes relevant. And the sentencing court that is interpreting its order that it issued when determining whether to revoke probation, and the district court judge here determined that this was a violation of the sentencing order it issued.
Judge Johnson, may I ask one follow-up question?
Yes, you may.
So, Mr. Smith, I haven't looked at the sentencing order in this case. Perhaps you can tell us, does the sentencing order, in addition to identifying specific conditions of probation, also require appellant to comply with any other conditions articulated by probation?
I believe it does, but let me double check. It does not appear to specifically say follow all other rules articulated by probation. It does require the defendant to have the have the sex offender assessment and follow all of the recommendations of that assessment, and that's, I guess that goes to the point that this recommend that this concept of no unsupervised contact with minor females comes out of the repeat sex offender assessment. It comes out of the treatment context, that is, and it's clear, I believe, from the file that treatment understood the whole concept of contact with unsupervised contact with minor females very broadly. So that it's not, it doesn't specifically say follow all of the rules as directed by your probation agent. So the answer, the straightforward answer to your question is no.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. McLaughlin, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess just beginning with the topic that was the most recent topic of discussion. The Minnesota Supreme Court has held both in the Ornelas case and in EY case that the condition, the base for the violation has to be a condition that was actually specifically imposed by the district court. And in both those cases, the district court found a probation violation based on something that the agent communicated to the individual after the individual was on probation, but not that was in the original sentencing order. And the court held that cannot form a basis for violation. So I think here this court really needs to look at what's actually in that sentencing order when determining it, and that the conditions can't be modified by what the probation officer told Mr. Specht. They can't be modified by the fact that the probation officer said his wife has to be the designated supervision person, and they can't be modified by any way that she defined what he could and could not do. It really all has to come back to what was actually put in that order that the district court issued. And here, the evidence doesn't show that he violated the condition as it was imposed by the district court. It doesn't show that he had unsupervised contact because his sister was present, and it also doesn't show that whatever contact he had was with unrelated females, because there's no evidence to show that in the record either. With the other main point I want to make was about this question about the definition of pornography. We agree that some of the definitions are broad enough to potentially encompass, the dictionary definitions are broad enough to potentially encompass images of oneself. But this court should read the condition also to be consistent with the Constitution, and under the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, should construe the condition to avoid a constitutional problem when possible. And when looking at it in terms of what the Constitution requires, it would create constitutional doubts if it was read to, if pornography was read to include images of oneself that someone shares with his or her spouse. That would create an obvious constitutional problem, both in terms of the right to privacy, the right to the sanctity of a marriage. So those constitutional doubts support a more limited definition of pornography as something that is not encompassed by the conduct that was alleged in this case. And then I guess the final point I'd like to make is this whole question of arguments that were raised in the reply brief. Those were, you know, raised in response to the argument that the state made and the arguments made in the state's brief. The principal brief written by appellant had the assumption that these issues were adequately preserved for this court's review. And the state raised for the first time in its brief that those issues were not preserved. And then the reply brief, offered several arguments to show that this court should consider the substance of the constitutional question. So those were proper arguments to raise in a reply brief, in our view, and the court should consider all of those arguments made in the reply brief. But taking a step back in this case, the violations here were either technical in nature, like the use of the phone, or else the evidence did not support the violations, as in the condition involving contact with unrelated minor females, or the conditions were really derivative of other conditions, like the violation of treatment. So looking at while there were, technical violations, they did not rise to the level of requiring revocation, where Mr. Specht had been in the community for 2 years, where he'd been engaged in treatment for that entire period, where he'd been working, where he had pro-social supports in the community, and where treatment had said he could return and continue his rehabilitation. Under all the circumstances, the policies of probation, the rehabilitation policy of probation, was not outweighed by a need for confinement, where he did not commit any new offense or engage in any behavior that that would warrant a prison sentence. Rehabilitation was possible for him in the community, and the policies in favoring probation should have led the court to allow him to return to community treatment.
Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin. Thank you, Mr. Smith. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days.